The court, please stand. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. At this time, we're on record Kenworth Sales versus Skinner Trucking. That is before the court for oral argument. Kenworth Sales Company is represented by Michael Danielson, the appellant, and respondents are Skinner Trucking, represented by Joseph Rockstall. Are there any preliminary matters?
No, sir.
Very well. You may proceed, sir.
Without re-arguing the briefing in this case, I'd like to draw the court's attention to what I see were a number of errors in its opinion. But first, I will give a brief rundown of the facts of the case. Here we have a case where respondents were a small trucking company, and they leased three trucks through what I refer to as GE Finance. The trucks were sold by Kenworth Trucking to GE Finance and then leased to Skinner Trucking. As the lease term ended or came near its end, Skinner Trucking was behind multiple months on its lease payments. They also realized that these trucks were worth considerably less than what the residual value under the lease was that they would have to pay on turn-in. Part of the agreement under the lease was that they would turn the vehicles in at the end of the lease. They would be sold, and then if they sold for above the residual value, that amount will be returned to the Skinner Brothers. If they were sold at below the residual value, the Skinner Brothers would be on the hook for deficiency. So as the lease term is ending, they're behind on payments. They realize that because there's problems with these trucks nationwide with their engines and recalls and whatnot, that they're worth considerably less. They also were trying to refinance the trucks. They were trying to purchase the trucks. They couldn't do either of that. So they realized that they had these trucks that they were going to face significant financial penalties on. Appellant Kenworth Trucking, who had a 40-year working relationship with Skinner Trucking, repairing trucks and doing other things for them, was aware of the position that they were in, was aware that the company was on the brink of perhaps going under, that they were behind on the payments, that these trucks were worth less than what they were going to give on the residual payments. So when respondents surrendered the trucks, Kenworth goes to GE and pays off both the delinquent payments and pays off the residual value on the trucks. And what they stated at the trial, why they did that, was because they wanted to stop the bleeding for Skinner Trucking. They didn't want Skinner Trucking to continue moving forward, getting further interest and penalties for payments that they knew they could not make when they turned the trucks in at the end of the lease. So the first issue that so this was an unjust enrichment case that we brought. And there's three elements of an unjust enrichment case. I'm not going to recite them. But the first issue that I have with the district court's opinion here is in its application of the first element of an unjust enrichment claim. And the first element is that there was a benefit conferred upon the defendant by the plaintiff. And in applying the first element of an unjust enrichment claim, the district court determined that with regard to the payoffs on the trucks themselves, that there was no benefit conferred on respondents. The district court did find with regard to the back unpaid lease payments that there was a benefit conferred. They did find that element one was met. But they found that element one was not met with regard to the actual payoffs on the truck. And in coming to that conclusion, the district court cited to the correct standard for element one. And that is that a benefit is conferred when one gives another some interest in money, land, or possessions, performs services beneficial to or at the request of another, satisfies the debt of another, or in any way adds to the other's advantage. And the district court, in its holding, its ruling, cited to the standard, But when applying that standard, the district court only focused on certain portions of it. The district court determined that the plaintiffs did not give the defendants any interest in money, land, or possessions, which is the first three parts of that standard, and that because the vehicle sold for the residual amount, because Kenworth paid the residual amount to GE when they paid off the vehicles, there was no debt for appellant's actions to have satisfied. So he addressed the debt element, and he addressed the interest in money, land, or possession aspects of the first element. And so at that point, the court determined that element one wasn't met. The court did not go further and analyze at all whether appellant's actions could have been classified as performance services beneficial to respondents or in any other way adding to respondent's advantage, which is a further part of that standard for element one. And so it's my contention that without engaging in that further analysis, that was error. When it comes to the second issue, so after determining that these residual buy-off payments didn't meet element one, the court does find that the back lease payments did satisfy element one. And then the court makes a statement saying, well, we find element one is satisfied with regard to that, and assuming the other two elements of unjust enrichment were satisfied, we now move forward and find a determination on officious intermeddling. So at that point, the court determines that unjust enrichment is inapplicable in our case because of the officious intermeddling doctrine. And the respondents in this case had never pled the officious intermeddling doctrine. They had never mentioned it. They had never argued the doctrine. The first time the doctrine even gets brought up is in the closing brief in this case. And the way this case went to court trial was we presented our evidence, we presented openings, we presented our evidence, and then the court asked if we wanted to give oral closings or written closings. And we decided to do written closings, and we were told to submit simultaneous written closings, and then the opinion would follow. So I drafted our written closing, and then when I got the written closing from the other side, its argument relied on this doctrine's defense that had not been pled, not been argued, not been brought up at all, even during trial. So I had no opportunity to respond to that.
What would you have done differently had you known officious intermeddler or unrequested intervention, as I think it's now referred to, had been alleged?
I would have focused on the voluntariness of the decision by Kenworth Trucking to make these payments, and I would have focused on whether or not there was a valid reason. Because part of the officious intermeddler doctrine is that it says if you were you simply volunteered to make these payments, you cannot rely on unjust enrichment unless you can then establish you had a valid reason for doing so. So it's a burden shifting that if you want to claim officious intermeddler, you establish that these were completely voluntary. The other side can then come back and establish that there was still a valid reason to make the payments. We didn't give them the opportunity to present that at all to the court, to argue that, to present evidence on that, because the argument that the defense hadn't been pled.
I want to make sure that I had your two points right. You said you would have focused on voluntariness
and the valid reason that Kenworth had to make the payment.
Why doesn't that fall into the third prong of the test for unjust enrichment, which is acceptance of the benefit under circumstances that would be inequitable for the defendant to retain the benefit without payment? I mean, it seems to me that whether the payment was made voluntarily and whether it was a valid reason goes straight to the equitable nature of the claim.
It does go straight to the equitable nature of the claim, and the claim is equitable. And the purpose of the officious intermeddler defense is also to apply equity to that. But there are ways that you can still have a valid reason to have made the payment, even if the three elements, including element three, are satisfied. And you still can have a finding that the third element is met, but that it was voluntary. or, so you can have a finding that all three elements of unjust enrichment are met, but because it was voluntary, it still cancels it out. And the way I read the cases that apply the doctrine, they don't state, here's element one, here's element two, here's element three, and oh, officious intermeddler is a part of that. It says, here's the elements, but an officious intermeddler cannot recover under unjust enrichment. And that's actually the way it was applied in this case. The judge says, I find that element one is here, was met here with regard to these back payments. Assuming elements two and three were met, now I don't do officious intermeddler, and I find that because of that.
Were there other, excuse me,
no, I didn't have anything.
Were there other accounts that were due and owing from Skinner to Kenworth at the time other than this transaction?
No.
Was Skinner in filing bankruptcy or any other legal, filing bankruptcy?
They were not filing bankruptcy, but in conversations between employees of Kenworth Trucking that had a long-time relationship with Jim Skinner, who was basically running Skinner Trucking, they were well aware, they were made aware by Jim Skinner
that they
of the financial situation, that they had tried to buy him, but they couldn't. They had tried to refinance him, and that they couldn't. And Jim Skinner admitted at trial that he knew the value of these trucks was well beneath the residual value at the time. And he goes ahead and turns them into Kenworth. And there was evidence presented at trial that Kenworth said, hey, we'll see what we can do here to stem the bleeding. The trucks are surrendered, and Jim leaves. So there was no agreement in that Jim Skinner didn't say, okay, go ahead and do it. But he drops them off, knowing that Kenworth has said, we'll try to do something here.
To what extent is Kenworth's allegation in the complaint that they mistakenly believed they had an obligation to GE? How does that factor into this case?
There was an employee at Kenworth that mistakenly believed that they had an obligation, and that's why that was added in the complaint. But in further discussion with my clients and then the evidence that came out of trial, it was determined that his misunderstanding was set straight before they made these payments and paid this off, and that these payments weren't made because Kenworth felt like they had to. These payments were made because Kenworth felt like it was an attempt by theirs to help out a very long-time client that they didn't want to see go under, and they felt that there was a good chance that Skinner Trucking was going to go under to help them out so that they could get back on their feet and not continue to incur further debt.
Does the act of dropping off the trucks vitiate the officious intermeddler doctrine?
I think it could if it establishes an agreement, maybe
that
not a
Skinner,
verbal agreement, but an agreement by action.
By Skinner giving the trucks, does that vitiate the voluntariness of Kenworth?
I think it could, and that's why we tried to present the evidence at trial that we did present, that before they turned the trucks in, the discussion was, we will take care of this, we will see what we can do for you, we will try to stop the bleeding, and then the trucks are surrendered, and Jim Skinner walks away.
Okay.
Was the complaint ever amended?
No.
So your theory is that it was tried on your position now is that it was tried on a different theory than was alleged in the complaint?
That is not my position.
What is your position?
My position is that Kenworth made these payments to pay off the residual value of the trucks and to pay off the back payments. And because they made those payments, and because before the Skinners turned in the trucks, they understood Kenworth was going to make those payments to help them out, that Skinner Trucking was unjustly enriched.
Isn't that a different theory than suggesting in the complaint that Kenworth thought they had an obligation to GE?
It is not, Your
Honor. I'm not sure I'm following it, so keep trying.
Kenworth Trucking, there was an employee that thought that they had an obligation to pay these off.
And which was alleged in the complaint.
Correct. Through discovery, we determined that that was not a company-wide understanding, that that was the understanding of this employee.
So the case gets tried on a different theory?
The case is tried on the theory of unjust enrichment. It was not tried on the theory that Kenworth was obligated to pay these fines. So it is the appellant's position that the vicious intermeddler doctrine is an affirmative defense, and that because it wasn't brought up, we weren't given the opportunity to even address it in closing briefing. We weren't given the opportunity to try to pull out different evidence at trial, to try to argue differently. So it ended up being our claim, our unjust enrichment claim, was denied on something that we were not given an opportunity to even address.
Are you aware of any other jurisdictions in which they have found that officious intermeddler is an affirmative defense?
I was not able to find a single case in another jurisdiction that even tackled the issue. And my final argument in this case is that even if it's found that it wasn't an affirmative defense and that it was therefore properly considered by the court, even though it wasn't pled or brought up, that the officious intermember was not properly applied by the court in this case. The district court here recognized that under the doctrine, the voluntary conferral of the benefit can preclude an unjust enrichment claim unless a valid reason existed. And so we presented at trial a valid reason why we did it, for Kenworth to try to help his longtime customer out, try to stem the bleeding, didn't want to see him go under. And in its opinion...
Well, wait, so you did present a valid reason? Because I thought, I understood your argument previously.
We presented evidence.
Okay, hold on a minute, because I understood your prior argument that you were prejudiced by the defense of this case because you did not present evidence on a valid reason.
I presented evidence that can be interpreted as a valid reason after the fact. Had I known that the officious intermeddler affirmative defense was being pled, I would have spent a lot more time, presented a lot more evidence, making sure I had a solidly established a valid reason, instead of having to go back and determine, I think this evidence meets that standard, but I would have done differently had it been on notice.
Indifferent, you mean you just would have been more thorough? Or that you would have presented a different type of evidence?
I would have presented more evidence on that.
So it wouldn't have been different, it just would have been more quantitatively?
It would have been probably more quantitatively and qualitatively, because more is not necessarily exactly what I did, just a little more, but we would have put on additional evidence.
But there are facts in the record that are essential for you to make the argument you ended up making in the case.
Well, I didn't end up making an argument with regard to a valid reason because I had no opportunity to do so.
Did you file a rebuttal brief?
There, we were told that we were to file closing briefs and then the decision would be made.
In light of the alleged ambush with this doctrine you were not familiar with, I'm curious why you didn't seek the right for further briefing to respond to that.
To be honest with you, one of the reasons why we did not file either a rebuttal brief or a motion to reconsider is because, number one, we decided that we would appeal it, and we decided that we'd be better off to appeal because, given the circumstances of the district court that ruled on the case and some unfortunate circumstances that followed.
It was a while ago, and I can't remember the pretrial order in this case, but was there an order for the attorneys to submit trial briefs prior to the commencement of the trial in this case?
I don't remember if there was an order to present pretrial briefs, but I know that there was nothing presented either pretrial or during trial until the closing brief that brought up the argument.
I seem to recall your opposing counsel confessing during an argument that he hadn't thought about the officious intermeddler theory until he wrote the brief after the trial. When did that hearing occur, and why did that hearing occur?
We had a hearing before Judge Schinderling, because by this point, Judge Stoker had passed. And at that hearing, it was a hearing on, so this opinion also said at the end, each party to bear their own costs. And so opposing counsel in this case filed a motion to reconsider seeking costs. So seeking to reconsider the part of the opinion that said, so we had a hearing before Judge Schinderling on costs and fees and reconsideration. And in that hearing, one of the bases for fees that the other side was attempting to pursue here was 12-121. So the argument was that the way we pursued the case was frivolous. And in making that argument, opposing counsel stated that this was a novel and a rare defense that he didn't discover until after he was doing research for his closing brief after trial. And on that, I would rest and reserve the remaining.
Thank you. On behalf of the respondent, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'd like to first start with kind of an apology. My wife and I wanted to be at the Inns of Court last night. She really wanted to be here today, but her father passed early Wednesday. She's dealing with that. And I'm likely going to be brief because I've been doing double duty. She's my office manager, but we have a good briefing. So some of what Mr. Danielson said I agree with. But over the years, when the Skinners turned in trucks, they just walked away. And they never got a deficiency, and they never got a check for an excess sale. It was always a wash. So 40 years of wash. And this one, in the trial, Kenworth admitted that they helped GE get the lease in place. So Skinners contract with GE to lease trucks. Kenworth sells their trucks to GE and then helps them with the lease. And at the end, they turn the trucks into the Kenworth lot. This time, Kenworth, at first they said, well, we thought we were obliged, and then they said, well, we think we're helping Skinners. I think it's just a history of we buy these trucks, clean them up, flip them, make a nice profit, because it's a residual lease value. And this one, and from we've heard all the discovery and all, these EGR trucks were very unreliable. So all these leases nationwide are coming due. They buy the trucks, and then after that, the value just drops. Nothing to do with Skinners. And
I'd like to talk about the officious intermeddler or the voluntariness of Kenworth. I can see if you and I are in a business relationship and the clerk Learman comes in and says, Burdick, I'll pay your bills. Doesn't tell me about it, but does. But in this situation, you seem to have initiated Kenworth's involvement in this case by delivering the trucks to Kenworth. Does that vitiate the officious intermeddler doctrine?
They've always turned them into Kenworth. 40 years. It wasn't always GE.
The course of dealing, I understand, but yeah. In this specific situation.
I think what it turns on is there was no agreement, no communication agreement between Skinner and Kenworth that, hey, we're going to help you out. I think the best they said at trial was what we thought it was understood. And I got asked everyone, because I'm starting to think, wait a minute, there is no agreement. You know, is there a sticky note where you wrote, we're going to help Jim Skinner? Is there a doodle on a calendar? Is there a memo, an email? There was nothing. So that is kind of like what you're saying. Someone comes in, pays your bills, and then turns around and says, you owe me. Pay it off.
Just so I'm clear then, would they have turned the trucks into Kenworth regardless of whether Kenworth had made or intended to make payments?
Correct.
That would have happened in any...
Yes,
any
there were Kenworth tractors, and GE says turn them into the Kenworth because they're going to recon them. They have the certified mechanics to get them ready to sell. So that turn them in there was not a new thing because Kenworth's buying them.
But you just said something, you said GE directed
Probably
dinner?
Sold.
No, not probably. What does the record show?
As I recall, Jim Skinner calls Kenworth and says, where do I take the trucks? And they say, you can drop them here. So, but that would have been at GE's direction because GE owns them, they're leasing them. So that's why that happened.
So you think Jim Skinner's testimony shows that? That's where I would look?
That's my recollection, yes. And then, kind of hitting high points in our answer, number 8, affirmative defense, we reserve the right to raise additional defenses as discovery and the process continue.
Would that be after the trial?
That, I'm not sure. So on that, on raising that, leading up to it, you know, we were told there's an agreement. Skinners don't have enough money for me to depose everybody involved. We deposed one guy, and he, I think, deferred to someone else, so I wait until trial. And I asked each one of them because of my gut, and I'm still not thinking of vicious intermeddler because law school was a long time ago. That's the last time I heard that term. Is just the pronounced fairness of you can't go pay someone's bills and then turn around and sue them for it unless you have an agreement. Yeah, well, you do that for me. And here, I'm just my gut was saying, if there's not an agreement, then this is wrong. And it was true. We finished, and I'm like, there's no agreement. This just seems wrong. Get on Lexis, boom, there's a fishless intermill. And I think there's 4 cases, 4 or 5 total in Idaho that deals with that. It's not a very common thing that's happened. But I noticed in the case we both, I think, referred to Curtis v. Baker, in the first paragraph of the opinion part, it says, the Beckers defended on the ground that because the purchase price they had paid the original developer for the lots included the cost of the improvements, they shouldn't have to pay a second time. But that case was decided on a vicious intermeddler. So what they started out was defending, we've already paid this. And at the end somewhere after, kind of like we did, they discover, oh, you're an vicious intermeddler. And in that case, which we haven't raised in this case, they looked at whether the intermeddler had clean hands. And in that one, it was here in Twin, and it involved a housing project and the roads. They had to finish the roads to get the city to sign off. And the Beckers didn't pay, because they said, we've already paid. We paid the original guy, you bought it from him. So the city said, we're not going to sign off if you don't pave in front of Beckers, because they paved everywhere else and left a little. So in that one, Curtis didn't receive anything. He had to pave the road. Here, Kenworth, bona fide third party, buys some trucks. So they get money and they get trucks to sell. It was a bad business decision that had nothing to do with Skinner. Whereas these other ones, there's no... The intermiddler is not buying anything. They're having to do something. So I think that's the distinction. And
well, let's talk about the underlying obligation. Did Skinner have an underlying obligation to pay GE the rent that they hadn't paid?
Yes.
And Kenworth paid that?
Yes.
And didn't Skinner have an underlying obligation to pay the difference between the residual and the value of the trucks?
Yes, to GE.
And Kenworth pays that?
Yes.
So Kenworth pays an obligation that Skinner owes?
Yes.
And they're an officious intermeddler for doing so?
Yes.
So I've gone back and looked at the new restatement, and it suggests that when one party steps in and assumes an obligation for another, that it doesn't discharge the obligation from the underlying obligor. And that strikes me as what happened in this case.
And as I mentioned at the beginning, the course of conduct, 40 years of never having a deficit or a surplus. You just turn the trucks in and walk away. So presumably, Kenworth was buying them and flipping them for a profit.
But the course of conduct doesn't necessarily discharge the obligation from Skinner to GE.
And between Skinner and GE, there's a lease obligation and there's trucks, which are assets. So GE is protected, and Skinner doesn't owe really anything until the trucks are sold and a shortfall or excess is determined. And the fact that they pay the full amount means Skinner owes nothing.
And the fact that Kenworth says that they intercede in order to keep GE from reclaiming the trucks and selling them at auction probably means that Skinner got a windfall.
It could, but it's somewhat speculative. It didn't happen. This bona fide third party, who actually has some inside knowledge, they're the truck broker, came and bought the trucks for their own profit. And then when it didn't work out, they turned around to sue Skinner.
But if it had worked out and they hadn't sued, nobody would...
If they, like the last 40 years, they sold their profit, Kenworth makes a profit, that was their motivation there.
But the last 40 years was a different contract, correct?
The various ones, yes.
And your client conceded that he had not read this contract and didn't know of its terms, correct?
I believe so.
If that's the case, then how can he rely on the course of dealings if there was a contract that changed the course of dealings?
I don't think, going from talking with the Skinners, I don't think the leases, the terms changed very much over the years. The interest rates and the purchase price, definitely, but at the end, it was always turn it in, and if there's a shortfall, you owe, and if there's excess, we'll send you a check.
But respectfully, I don't think that's responding to my question. If there was a contract, doesn't that make the prior course of dealings irrelevant? Especially where your client conceded that he didn't read the contract?
Yes. All I can say is it could. The contract controls, prior course of dealing gives us some guidance, I would say.
Only if there's an ambiguity in the contract. Isn't that usually when you look at course of dealings?
Yes.
Or if there's a question about whether there is a contract or not, you sometimes look at course of dealings?
Yes.
But if you have a contract that's unambiguous but unread by one of the parties, does the course of dealings play any role in the analysis?
For the contract itself, I would say no, when we don't have those alleged problems.
But wouldn't course of dealing factor into a claim of unjust enrichment, and in particular the third prong that deals with whether requiring payment would, the equities of it, that is, whether it would be unjust? And doesn't course of dealing factor into that analysis?
I would say so. That's what we went on. You know, 40 years we drop off the charts and walk away, and then the one time there's a shortfall, you're suing us. But it's not GE. It should have been GE sell them, and GE say, okay, there's a shortfall, you guys owe us. But here, Kenworth purchased them, you know, wrote a check and got the titles. These are our trucks now. And then it turns out it's a bad deal. So that's, I would say that's different from Mr. Chief Justice saying, you know, she comes and pays, say, his medical bill. She doesn't receive anything for that. She's just helping someone out. And then to say, can you pay me back? But this is, I bought some trucks, and wow, I didn't talk to you about it. I just bought them. It turns out it was a colossally bad deal. I'm going to sue you. And Skinners are going, why? We didn't have anything to do with this. We're used to just walking away. And if there's a problem, it should have been with GE. That's our contract. But then on switching to attorney's fees, the 12120 analysis, it says every transaction that is not highlighted, not personal or household purposes, is a commercial transaction. And the gravamen of this goes to a lease between Skinner and GE and a purchase from Kenworth from GE. So everything, all the terms everyone's arguing involves this track lease and the purchase and sale of these semi-trucks, which I don't think have ever been personal or household items.
But aren't you saying there wasn't a contract between Skinner and Kenworth?
Absolutely.
And don't you have to have a contract between Skinner and Kenworth to recover under 12120 sub 3?
I don't believe so.
That's certainly our case law.
The case I found said Great Plains Equipment versus Northwest Pipeline. 12120.3 requires a commercial transaction between the parties, but it doesn't require a contract between the parties.
So what was the commercial transaction between Kenworth and Skinner?
Kenworth assisted GE and Skinner in getting the lease put in place and then purchased the trucks out from under Skinner, if you will, without any communication.
So you're saying the transaction exists in two ways, a commercial transaction. What happened at the end, which I think some of us are having difficulty with, is the basis. But you've just suggested something happened at the beginning of the transaction that would fulfill that. Could you develop that a little more for us?
And I, over the last 2 days reading, one of Kenworth's people said, yes, we helped GE get these leases put in place and work with Skinner's, so they're kind of an intermediary, an agent, if you will, for GE in getting the lease in place.
So they weren't an officious intermeddler then, they were an officious intermediary?
They're an agent getting some trucks leased, and with lots of communication and written documentation, which we don't have on purchasing the trucks, basically on their own.
Well, if you concede they were an agent at the beginning, why shouldn't we assume they were acting as an agent at the end instead of as an intermeddler?
I have no evidence of that. All we have is Kenworth. Yeah, we paid full price for them, and we paid your lease thing.
But you can see how that seems inconsistent. Yeah. At the beginning, you consider them an agent, but at the end, they're an intermeddler.
Well, at the end, there's no paperwork, no agreements. So they're, as the intermediary, they're saying, okay, GE bought the trucks, so they're going to lease them to you for X a month for 3 years. So there's an agreement, there's a price, there's papers everyone signs. Then at the end, they get a phone call, basically, drop the trucks at Kenworth. And then no paperwork, no phone calls after that. Kenworth buys the trucks on their own. Bona fide third party, I would argue.
Well, Kenworth's got a vested financial interest on both ends of the deal, right? When they're helping to sell the trucks to GE, and also when they're buying the trucks when they pay off the residual value.
Yes. I agree. They get a good price selling, and then hopefully they get a good price at the end of the lease that'll, as they have for 40 years, presumably buy them and flip them and make a profit. The one night, the 12-1-21 argument. So, if Kenworth is an officious intermeddler, then suing under that is baseless and therefore be frivolous.
But wouldn't you have an obligation to alert Kenworth to that fact if you're seeking attorney's fees? I mean, it's a little hard for me to understand how you get to say they're an officious intermeddler after the fact and that they should pay the attorney's fees before the fact. What I'm trying to say is that if you had said you're an officious intermeddler at the outset, they might have had a decision to make as to whether to pursue it. But after the fact, it's hard for me to say, well, it was frivolous when they didn't know your defense.
But we did an offer in judgment for the roughly $7,000 the lease payments to kind of concede, you know what, you did pay that, and it could be a benefit to us, so we offered to settle this for that amount.
And so then they weren't an officious intermeddler when it came to the lease.
Yeah, the court found they were, because there was absolutely no communication, and I would argue the reason for doing it was Kenworth to turn a profit again on flipping these trucks.
But you see how an offer of judgment cuts right against your argument that it was frivolous.
Well, 7,000, maybe not frivolous, but the other part. Because we're saying that the other is ridiculous. It never should have. So we went with their complaint, oh, we made a mistake and wrote a check to GE. They're agents of GE. They should have been able to say, that was a mistake, give us a check back and we'll sell the trucks for you. But apparently that never happened. They would have kept the trucks and then went to sell them.
Are we done with the cost issue now?
Yes, I believe so. We've stipulated to that. I believe that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does the appellate have?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir.
Before dealing with the fees issue, I'd like to bring up something that was discussed by respondents here. It keeps being mentioned that my people just made a bad business decision, that Kenworth just made a bad business decision. Kenworth was trying to flip these trucks. There is no evidence that was presented at trial that during this 40-year relationship, Kenworth ever bought these trucks back and sold them for a surplus, let alone whether they kept that surplus and didn't give it to the Skinners. There was no evidence that they ever received surplus, received a windfall. So there's no basis for an argument that they were attempting to just flip trucks. In fact, at trial, Jim Skinner admitted that before he turned the trucks in, he realized that because of the market on these trucks and what was going on with the engines, that they were worth $42,000, which was considerably less than the $58,000 on these residual values. The Kenworth people testified that they knew that these trucks were worth way less than the residual values at the time. So there's no basis for an argument that my people made a decision here just to try to flip these and make a quick profit, and that as soon as they paid them off to GE, they realized, oh, the market just tanked, and now we're stuck with these trucks.
There's Doesn't no that argument kind of belie economic reality, though? Are you telling me for 40 years, Kenworth has existed by getting these leasebacks and then selling them at a loss?
We don't have a record of what happened.
Well, I know we don't know what happened, but I'm just trying to see if what you're suggesting happened makes any sense in the real world of economics.
I do know that the trucking market did, because of the problems that these engines were having over a number of years, drop.
Yeah. This would be an instant for where it went bad, but if it went bad every time, that would be a pretty poor business model, don't you think?
Well, and let me give you my impression of the records so you can tell me if it's inaccurate, if this is a misimpression. My impression of the record is that over the 40 years, these two parties had been able, whether it be through positive residual values or new financing arrangements, they had been able to basically roll from one lease or financing arrangement to the next without either party suffering any kind of economic loss.
There was an arrangement in the course of dealing over this 40 years where amounts, whether it was a residual deficiency amount due or a surplus, could be rolled into the next lease, because every time prior to this lease in which they would turn in the trucks, it was followed by an immediate release of new trucks. This was the first time that they had done this, where because they were in such financial straits, they couldn't lease new trucks.
So this
they couldn't buy new trucks.
So is my impression accurate then?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So with regard to the fees issue, there have been three bases for fees that I think have been argued here and that were denied by the district court. One was fees under Rule 68. I have argued that there is strong case law in Idaho that says that Rule 68 is simply not a basis for fees. There is the 12-121 fees, which were already argued at the district court level. The standard of review for 12-121 fees is abuse of discretion. Respondents' counsel has not pointed out in any way how Judge Schinderling abused discretion in denying 12-121 fees in this case. Simply trying to re-argue what he argued for Judge Schinderling is that this is a frivolous case. So I don't think he's met that burden. And with regard to 12-123, it is my understanding that to be a commercial transaction, to make 12-120 sub 3 apply, it does have to be a commercial transaction between the parties.
How is this not a commercial transaction between the parties?
Are you referring to the turn-in of trucks by the Kenworths? Because two arguments were made up here by respondents earlier. One is that because years earlier, when Skinner Trucking wanted these trucks and they came, they decided to lease them because they couldn't purchase them from Kenworth. Kenworth sells them to GE and GE leases them. And the argument was made that that is a commercial transaction sufficient to satisfy that. And it's my argument that that is not at all the gravamen of this case. The gravamen of this case is not based on a contract or an agreement. It's based on years later when they turn these trucks in to Kenworth.
But what about Mr. Rockstall's point that our case law says it doesn't have to be a contract, it's a commercial transaction?
It says it doesn't have to be a contract, it does have to be a commercial transaction between the parties. And here, we have a party that has spent their entire time in this case arguing that there's no transaction whatsoever. There's no agreement, there's no nothing, there's no evidence of anything. We just simply drop these trucks off, and we have this efficient member that steps in and decides to take them and pay them off. And then for them to come in when they want fees and claim that that somehow creates a transaction now Frankly, I would think that the doctrine of estoppel should preclude them from coming in.
Haven't we held that in reverse, that if a party comes in and alleges that there's a contract and a commercial transaction, they're stopped from saying there wasn't one later in the case? This would be the reverse of that?
You have, yes, Your Honor. And it is that the case law in 12.120 sub 3 seems to be that there is a commercial transaction between the parties, or that a commercial transaction was alleged between the parties. And neither of those are present.
Well, what about the fact that Kenworth, in its complaint, alleges that fees are owed under 12.120? And I will give you that it does not specify a particular subsection. But what other subsection under 12.120 might apply?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I know that when complaints are drafted and rules are thrown in there, statutes for fees, a lot of times rules are thrown in there just so that something isn't waived later. And
so you'd agree with me that a Kenworth truck worth $70,000 a day of purchase is not a used at the dinner table. It's not personal. It was not used personally. It was used for a commercial reason, correct? And 40 years of commercial transactions between Kenworth and Skinner took place before. As a result, they went back to their truck dealer, got another truck for a commercial transaction. Things went south. They went back to their dealer and said, hey, can you help us? Here's the trucks. Is that for a personal reason?
It was not established at trial that Skinner Brothers went to Kenworth and said,
what about the cases that say the gravamen of the case is commercial? Is there anything in this that's personal other than commercial entities dealing together?
This isn't a personal court claim. So I understand that had there not been a commercial lease by Skinner with GE for these trucks, we wouldn't be here. But I don't think that's the standard. I don't think it's if there's a commercial transaction tangentially involved, then those fees apply. I think it still has to be a commercial transaction between the parties.
Well, it's a good argument, but the onions on my ravioli last night were not sliced as thinly as you're trying to do here. Anything further, sir?
No, Your Honor.
Very good. This matter is now under advisement. We'll enter an opinion.